Europe is experiencing the largest wave of refugees since World War II and is desperate to find a long-term solution. Join America Abroad for a town hall discussion linking New York to Berlin on iTunes and PRI.org/America Abroad.
Boots on the ground in Syria, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Obama plans to send a few dozen special forces into northern Syria. With Russian jets overhead, it could easily turn deadly.
This is just an accident waiting to happen, and I don't see the U.S. giving the Russians their coordinates when their forces are on the ground. That's not going to happen.
Plus, was China's one-child policy good for the planet? Some say yes.
But, you know, they don't understand how it had to be implemented with force and coercion. Or maybe they didn't care because they were far away on the other side of the world.
And the cost of doing business in Iran for Iranian Americans.
As one businessman told me, you know, if Iran doesn't want our expertise, our money, and our network, we can take our business elsewhere.
Those stories coming up today on The World.
The World is brought to you with support from Audible.com. With over 180,000 audiobooks, Audible is a core tool for anyone seeking to be more productive, better informed, and thoughtfully entertained. You can learn more at audible.com/theworld. And from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving, with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Zoom way in on the war in Syria, and it's about people, the ones fighting and the ones fleeing, too. So many Syrians are risking everything to flee the war and make it to Europe. Coming up, we'll hear the story of one little boy from Syria who went missing in the chaos. First, though, we zoom out to talk about the big picture. Today was the first day of talks in Vienna on how to end the war. Secretary of State John Kerry is there discussing Syria's future with his counterparts from Russia, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and several other nations. The Pentagon, meanwhile, announced it's deploying U.S. special forces to Syria. No more than 50, reportedly, as advisors in the fight against ISIS. We're going to discuss all of this with Amr al-Azm. He's a professor at Shawnee State University in Ohio and a member of the Syrian opposition here in the U.S. First of all, Amr, these special forces troops, what kind of difference are they really expected to make?
I don't think they're going to make that much of a difference on the ground. I mean, there's only 50 of them, and their role is going to be primarily probably supportive, advisory, helping out with strategy and tactics, and really to kind of bolster morale. And I think possibly even in part to ensure that there's enough emphasis given on some of the priorities that the United States has with regards to the nature of the operations that are going to be carried out in the areas where they're going to be deployed. And I suspect they're going to be deployed with the Kurds, and they're going to be hopefully, or what the U.S. will hope is that they'll be then able to, influence how these activities are carried out on the ground with regards to pursuing ISIS out and beyond the areas that are areas of interest for the Kurds.
It occurs to me with Russia in this fight, there have got to be worries about the consequences if Russian warplanes accidentally hit U.S. special forces.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is just an accident waiting to happen. And despite all reassurances to the contrary, I doubt very much that there is any real coordination happening beyond, you know, the very superficial cursory. I don't see the U.S. giving the Russians their coordinates when their forces are on the ground. That's not going to happen, even though the Russians have demanded that, obviously. And I don't see the Russians really, you know, avoiding areas where the U.S. are operating out of fear of hitting them. I think both sides are going to continue to do what they do and you know, eventually, it's very likely that if this goes on for any length of time, that an accident will happen.
As to those talks in Vienna, I mentioned the 18 partner nations involved, Russia, Iran, and Saudi Arabia. I noticed there are almost no Syrians there. What's going on?
Well, not almost. There are no Syrians, not from the regime side and not from the opposition side. But it's also quite interesting how the even the build-up to the meeting was unfolding. You had the Qataris and you had the Saudis in particular make very forceful statements about their expectations particularly vis-a-vis Assad. So they were very combative. And I noted today, for example, that the Iranians, on the other hand, what I consider to be quite conciliatory in comparison to what the Saudis were saying, for example. The Iranians actually stated today that they would be willing to consider the departure of Assad through maybe through a six-month transition period with some sort of election or some sort of deal cut that way. And unless we see a shift in that, the talks aren't really going to do much. You know, pundits are even suggesting that if they can keep everybody in the room for the day and not have people walk out, that in itself would be an achievement.
And just keep everyone in the room until the end of the day. Amir Al-Azm, yes. Professor at Shawnee State University and a member of the Syrian opposition here in the States. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now to the story of that little Syrian boy I mentioned earlier, a six-year-old named Azam who vanished in the chaos of the migrant passage to Europe. My BBC colleague John Sweeney met Azam in Serbia about a month ago. The little boy was in a hospital in Belgrade, recovering from a car accident, but he disappeared before doctors were ready to release him. John and his producer started looking for Azam. Their search sparked a social media campaign, hashtag Find Azam. John Sweeney went to our studio in London to bring us this update.
We found him. It was a wonderful, wonderful moment. It wasn't easy, Marco. It wasn't easy. He's a little boy, lovely brown eyes, olive complexion, curly hair. And what happened was we retraced his steps. So I first met him in Serbia in mid-September, and he had a broken jaw, a massive bandage, and a bit of a black eye. And the men with him were a little fishy, if I may say so. There was a man who said, like, I'm the father, but he didn't seem very convincing about it. And a Serb medic at a makeshift clinic was wiping the wound, and the poor kid was crying. Our interpreter was worried and said, is this guy really your father? And the kid said, no, he's my uncle. What happened next was that he vanished from hospital before proper treatment. So some people were worrying on social media that he'd been kidnapped or something very dark had happened. Our colleagues from BBC Arabic were also looking online and Facebook. And eventually our colleague Mamdou Absiak found the uncle's Facebook page, which was wonderful news. The problem was it didn't have his name on it and it didn't have his whereabouts. But he was sitting on a kind of park bench, and behind him was a shop. And this is where the smart stuff comes. Not me, my Serb fixer, Ivan Angelovski. What he did was he looked at it. And in the back of the shop, there's a sports shop. And there are only two sports shops like this in the whole of Germany, one in Munich, one in Berlin. Which one is it? In the windows of the sports shop were reflected the windows of the building opposite, round windows, and underneath them, square windows.
Wow.
And we looked at it online, and we Google Maps, blah, 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 and we could geolocate him to this park bench in Munich. So we were on the case. We drive 500 miles, and there he is. There's the uncle. There's the little boy. And we take them for a meal. I want to give Azam a meal. And his jaw was bad. When he got to Germany, he spent 10 days in hospital. But he was a bonny chap, full of fun, very shy to begin with, as kids are. And towards the end, he was sticking his tongue out of the camera. We travel 1,500 miles to find this kid, and he sticks his tongue at you.
That's
children.
Great. So the social media campaign helped, and good old gumshoe work. You were talking about Azam's uncle earlier. He originally told you he was Azam's father. He also discharged the boy from the hospital against medical advice. What do you think was going on there?
A phrase I used is a gold rush psychosis, which is that people are running from the war in Syria, and Azam and his uncle are from Damascus, but they're desperate to get to Germany, and it becomes a kind of strange, almost brainwashed fixation. We must get to Germany, we must get to Germany, above all other considerations, including the health of Azam. But if you think about it, now, I think it was wrong what the uncle did to take the boy out of hospital, but essentially the rules are you're only allowed 3 days inside Serbia before you have to apply for asylum. And what the uncle was afraid of was being trapped in Serbia, and Serbia doesn't want the refugees. It permits them to pass through Serbia. It doesn't want them. So there was a kind of, I think the decision by the uncle to take him out of hospital was wrong. I can understand why he made the mistake that he did do.
In the overall narrative of the refugee and migrant crisis, which is just filled with tragic tales of drowning and separation of families. What's it been like to be at the center of a good news story?
Oh, joyful. Joyful. I saw this lad happy, mucking about, having fun. It was one of the sweetest things I've ever seen in my whole life. It's beautiful.
All right, John. We're going to leave it there. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
My BBC colleague John Sweeney in London.
Thank you.
The Volkswagen cheating scandal is still fresh on our minds. The company has admitted that its supposedly clean diesel cars actually emit up to 40 times the legal limit for certain tailpipe pollutants. So what does that mean for our health? As the world's Jason Margolis reports, researchers at MIT and Harvard now have some answers.
PJ Goodwin has always loved Volkswagens. I mean, really loved them. He flashes his lights and waves at other VW owners on the road.
I definitely felt a magnetism towards vintage VWs. My first car was a VW 1972 camper. I still have it. Yeah, I was a kid when I bought it. I didn't even have my driver's license.
Goodwin also has a 2010 diesel Volkswagen Jetta Sportwagon. That's one of the tainted cars. He says he bought it first and foremost because it was an environmentally friendly choice. It's clear he's deeply bothered by Volkswagen's big lie. But like all VW owners, Goodwin really didn't know how his car's emissions were impacting people.
So I'm meeting with these professors at Harvard and MIT this afternoon. And they've found that all of our diesels combined are contributing to 59 premature deaths with all of our emissions. Whoa. You seem surprised. How does it make you feel?
Wow. Yeah, I'm shocked. I mean, well, to put an actual number of fatalities on is pretty shocking.
Let's be clear, researchers aren't saying 59 people will drop dead tomorrow. The lead author of the new study, Stephen Barrett with MIT, says they've calculated statistical averages to gauge the impact of excess emissions from VWs sold between 2008 and 2015.
You can't knock on someone's door and say, sorry, you're going to die early. All we can do is say, for the U.S. population as a whole, about 60 people will lose between 10 and 20 years of their life.
David Keith at Harvard was also on the research team. He says the new study is not just to point fingers at Volkswagen, but to help people understand the severe consequences of air pollution.
Many of the public don't understand that, in fact, air pollution, much more than water pollution or food contamination or anything else, is the thing that really kills people. Air pollution overall cuts more than a year off the life of an average American. It's a very big number.
Roughly 50,000 Americans die prematurely each year from power generation emissions. The number of people impacted by these VW emissions is a fraction of a fraction of that. Now, full disclosure, I own a 2011 Volkswagen Golf Diesel, one of the rogue cars. There's nearly a half million of us on the roads in the U.S. If you do the math, assuming we've all driven the same amount, we've each taken slightly less than a half day off of somebody's life. Terrible. Still, that doesn't feel like much, considering how much coal we burn to power our homes. David Keith says that's the wrong attitude.
Each individual car makes no difference at all, but that's not thinking systematically about morality. If you threw your garbage out on the street, it wouldn't make Boston a totally polluted place, but if collectively we all threw our garbage in the street, it would be a disaster. And the point is, individual cars matter once you add them up.
Here's the tricky part, though. I'm feeling guilty about my car, but a recall could reduce its fuel efficiency.
You feel bad about your car, but in fact, your car is still a very efficient car, which means it has good gas mileage, which means that actually on a climate basis, it would be relatively low in the climate pollution, which is the carbon pollution. And one of the other lessons here is there are trade-offs. There's no free lunch. We can't get everything.
Still, Keith encouraged me to fix my car when a recall is ready. Stephen Barrett with MIT says they've also calculated the impacts if no cars are recalled.
The existing vehicles that are already out there would cause an additional 140 deaths if they stayed on the road for their lifetime.
Barrett estimates that if those cars are recalled quickly, 90% of those premature deaths could be averted. PJ Goodwin, who this week became a plaintiff in a class action suit against VW, says he'll fix his diesel.
One thing that I've been thinking a lot about lately, you know, after going through all of this, is that there really is no clean car.
A few weeks ago, he got himself a new ride. a bike. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. The nuclear deal between Iran and the U.S., we thought, would bring with it a new start. You know, better understanding between the two countries, maybe even renewed economic ties. But there are reports today about yet another Iranian-American arrested in Iran. Right now, there are at least three other dual citizens in prison there. Jason Rezaian of The Washington Post is one of them. For more on the businessman at the center of this latest case, I spoke with Farnaz Fasihi. She's a reporter with The Wall Street Journal.
Siamak Namazi is an Iranian-American. He is an oil consultant. He was the head of strategy at an oil company based in Dubai. When he lived in Iran, he was a consultant at a family-run business giving advice to foreign companies interested in investing in Iran. He's quite well-known in business circles and has been an advocate for better economic relations between Iran and the West.
So had he been visiting Tehran when he was arrested?
Correct. He'd been visiting his family in Tehran when he was arrested.
And so what do you know about how he was arrested and why all this happened?
He was arrested from his family home. Intelligence agents from the Revolutionary Guards Corps raided his house. They confiscated his laptop and his belongings and took him to the notorious Evin prison, where most of the political dissidents are jailed. The Iranian government has not acknowledged his arrest. We do not know what the allegations or the charges are. But, we can only suspect that this has to do with the internal struggle going on in Iran between President Rouhani's moderate faction and the hardliners who really oppose any sort of opening of Iran to the outside world.
Yeah, explain a bit more about that rift between the hardliners and President Rouhani's government.
So Iran works in a parallel sort of a power structure where you have the president and the government and the parliament, but their power is overshadowed by the supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, and increasingly the Revolutionary Guards Corps, which are, you know, an elite unit of Iran's armed forces. They are a very powerful intelligence wings. The hardliners, which are aligned with the supreme leader and the guards, were not in favor of a nuclear deal. They are not in favor of opening up Iran's market to the outside, investors. Particularly, they're very wary of American influence there. There's been a number of comments recently about how the nuclear deal does not automatically translate into American businesses entering Iran. And they think that by opening up Iran economically, they might not be able to control the social changes that that will bring.
So a lot of Iranians with dual citizenships might be thinking post-nuclear deal, let's get our foot in the door, do some business. I mean, we knew the risks for dual nationals who are journalists going to Iran, but now this seems like business people also have to be on the lookout. How's this going to impact the new prospects for business?
It's already sent chills through the business community, both inside and outside of Iran. I interviewed a number of businessmen inside Iran who said that in the past couple of weeks, they've been interrogated, they've been under surveillance, they've been told to stay away from foreign investors. The businessmen and investors of Iranian descent who are in America and in Europe who are interested in Iran now have serious reservations in light of Mr. Namazi's arrest because they thought that they were going to go do something good. As one businessman told me, if Iran doesn't want our expertise, our money and our network, we can take our business elsewhere.
You seem to chalk this up to the rift between the hardliners and President Rouhani's government. Is that rift significant enough that it could affect Iran-U.S. relations?
Absolutely. I think that Iran is not ready, the regime in Iran is not really ready to have normal relations with the United States post the nuclear deal. I think that's been made very clear in comments from Ayatollah Khamenei and from commanders of the guards. They think that the nuclear deal is enough in itself.
Farnaz Fasihi, a reporter with The Wall Street Journal, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
Our next story will be difficult to listen to, but I want you to hear it because it's important. And though it may seem like a hopeless tale, there is a small silver lining to it. More on that in a moment. The story is about a woman named Reshma Qureshi. I met her when I was in Mumbai last month, reporting for our year-long project, Across Women's Lives. One side of her face is painfully disfigured. The other side of her face, flawless, as if nothing ever happened. Reshma was the victim of an acid attack. Last year, her brother-in-law, along with his cousins, grabbed Reshma in the street and threw battery acid in her face. She was seriously burned and lost an eye. Reshma Qureshi is 18 years old. I met her and her family in her tiny apartment in the Mumbai slum of Chembur. She told me about the countless surgeries she's gone through in the past year, with more to come to repair her face.
My head hurts, my scalp hurts. They've taken skin from all over my body to rebuild my face. There is skin from my head that's been used to rebuild my left eye. And everything hurts. When I cry, tears do come out of my left eye as well. They've left a gap, so I can cry from both eyes. And my face, you know, I feel extremes of heat. If the fan's not on, I feel like it starts to burn. The skin feels very hot. And sometimes it just gets stiff. When I wake up in the mornings, I feel like something heavy has been placed on my face and I can't really move it.
Have you met any other women who have been attacked with acid?
I've met two other survivors who are under the care of the same doctor. One of them is Kalpana. Her surgeries are over. And the other is Lalita. Lalita is actually worse off than I am. The first time I met her, I said, Allah, I have suffered so much and I bear so much. And look at this girl. And looking at her pain and her situation actually took me outside of myself for the first time. And I really felt like it was so unjust. There's so much injustice. These boys, they look at a pretty face, they can't have it, and they throw acid in her face and they spoil an entire life. They're running around free. We are the ones confined to a room. We're living lives of misery. And I felt for the first time this was just so unfair that we're just girls, we haven't done anything, and these horrible people were still running around having fun in their lives while we're confined to all this pain and misery. It's just not fair.
There seems to be in India a high value placed on beauty. How have you kind of reassessed that value since the attack on you?
In our society, the benevolent gaze is always on the good-looking. And I myself am sort of guilty of it because I look at myself and I think of how pretty I was back then and I feel differently now. But whatever had to happen, happened, and I have a lot of courage in me and I'm trying to see that what I realized is that a face is just a face. There are people that God has not blessed with even this, with worse. What can they do? It's not their fault. What matters is your inside. What matters is your heart. If your heart's clean, your face will reflect it in a different way. And I think everybody should try to aspire to that. What's happened has happened, but I'm fine now and I'm going to be even better. That's what I tell myself.
That was 18-year-old Reshma Qureshi, a victim, but also the face of courage. Since the attack, Reshma has become the spokesperson for online tutorials on applying makeup. She works with a group called Make Love, Not Scars, which is working to ban the sale of acid in India. In the process, Reshma has become a role model. To learn more about Reshma's incredible story and her efforts to stop the use of sulfuric acid as a weapon, come to PRI.org for our video story about Reshma. Again, that's at PRI.org. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Castle Frankenstein is a real place in Germany, and at Halloween it teems with werewolves, scary clowns, and more.
He has this bad baby with a knife as a monster here. It's good looking. It's very good looking.
Okay, I'm creeped out. Visit to Castle Frankenstein, ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International and by Soundworks.org, offering perspectives on events and cultures around the globe with The World's Daily Podcast and the Studio 360 Podcast. Subscribe at Soundworks.org or iTunes.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. So what if China scrapped its one-child policy? That is the big news from Beijing this week. Looking back, though, this policy was once hailed by the Chinese Communist Party and some environmental advocates as a way to stop overpopulation. So we want to dig into that right now, how this cap on the number of children couples can have has impacted China's environment, not to mention the world's. It's a pretty nuanced topic, and Mei Fong says it requires us to look at more than just population. She's the author of One Child, The Past and Future of China's Most Radical Experiment.
You got to ask yourself,
could these births have been averted or reduced by more humane measures? You know, sending women to college, educating them more, encouraging contraception, all the things that China was already doing. And you might ask yourself, too, the motivation for the one-child policy was economic growth at all costs. Now, it's the same mindset that led to, you know, very lax environmental procedures. You know, despite the one-child policy, China is the largest polluter in the world. And my argument is because of this mindset that we must grow economically at all costs. We don't care. That has led to this pollution problem, not the number of babies born in China.
So if this didn't work out in your view for China's environment, the net result being a bigger middle class, more cars, more manufacturing, more lax environmental regulations, are you able, Meifeng, to make the connection to the global environment and how the one-child policy affected the rest of the world? Because we know pollution doesn't stop at borders.
No, it doesn't. Let's take, for example, air pollution, right? There was a period in time where China was at a sort of deciding between going the European way of transportation, you know, more public transportation, more trains, or going the American way, more personal cars. Now, the personal cars issue obviously played, you know, because a lot of state-owned companies manufacture cars. This is where the wealth came in. And then the result is you have, you know, way too much traffic problems and pollution problems. So that was one area where it had nothing to do with one-child policy. It was something else in the way of a determination of where the country should go. And so these were the errors made that I think played a much more significant role. I'm not saying that population control is a bad thing, but I'm saying that the way they went about it was wrong-headed and extreme and problematic.
Regardless of China's intent with the one-child policy, limiting families to one child essentially took away free choice. What are your thoughts on this delicate balance between being good stewards of the planet and leaving people with free choice?
Well, you know, here's the thing, right? I mean, there are many ways to being good stewards of the planet. And if reduction of people is one way, but you can go about it in lots of ways, right? You know, if you had a major war, you'd reduce the population significantly. But is that a good thing? At some point, you have to ask yourself, what are we saving the planet for if we don't preserve some elements of humanity? You know, are there better ways of doing it? I think definitely the one-child policy was not a good way to do it, not at all. Not when you balance it against all the forced sterilizations, abortions, and all the huge, egregious human rights abuses. I mean, you know, let's take slavery as an analogy. You know, if you dial back, you know, at the time when slavery is around and you ask people and they say, well, you know, well, it was in the Bible. Or no, well, it's really necessary for agricultural production in the South. You know, those might have seemed like very valid arguments then, but you look back now and you say, well, no, it was a huge an evil thing that was very bad for humanity. And I think whereas we look at the one-child policy now and people sort of say, no, it was actually a good thing for the planet. But, you know, they don't understand the repercussions of this policy. And they didn't understand how it had to be implemented with force and coercion. Or maybe they didn't care because they were far away on the other side of the world. Now, I've interviewed a lot of environmentalists about this and population planners, and some of them, of course, do say, well, we should have a global one-child policy. And, you know, this is in no way scientific, but I've always found to my astonishment that the people who say that, and then when I go ahead and say, well, how many children do you have? I usually find out that they have more than one child. They have multiple children. And so it's a question of do as I say, but not do as I do.
Meifeng, the author of One Child, The Past and Future of China's Most Radical Experiment. Thanks for speaking with us, Meifeng.
Thank you.
From the environment in the world's most populous country to what's happening in one of the least populated ones, the Marshall Islands, way out in the middle of the Pacific. From the end of World War II up until 1979, the Marshalls were administered by the U.S. Now they're independent, and the island nation faces a huge challenge in the form of rising sea levels linked to climate change. It's an existential threat for them. The Marshall Islands Foreign Minister, Tony DeBroom, tweeted recently, "My home is under climate attack." De Broome is on a global tour trying to drum up support for a global climate deal that could save his homeland. We reached him today at the airport in Hawaii.
It's really much worse than anyone can imagine at this point. There are predictions of sea level rising, but what is happening now is reverse winds, any king tide that washes over the island, we've got even salt water springing up through the soil. it's something that we want to get the world's attention focused upon, because too many people think that this is something that is being predicted for 2050. For most of the atoll vulnerable states, it's already happening. And we need to come up with ideas to maintain confidence that the world will not let these islands go under.
Let's say global average temperatures continue to rise. What are the prospects for the Marshall Islands over the next few decades?
Well, if the temperatures are not maintained well below 2 degrees, then you're talking about inundation of the Marshall Islands as early as 2030 and up. And for Tuvalu, Tokelau, the Federated States of Micronesia, it would be the same. This is not something that's just happening in the Pacific. It's also happening in the Indian Ocean. It's happening in the Caribbean.
How many people from the Marshall Islands are trying to leave because of what they're seeing around them?
Just from Bikini Atoll alone, we are estimating 2,500 people of Bikini who had been displaced from Bikini in the first place for atomic nuclear testing are now petitioning. And I'm very happy to tell you that Assistant Secretary of Interior Esra Kia Aina has been working closely with us to make sure that the people's request for accommodation in the United States is upheld by Congress. We've been compelled to live in an island which does not have a lagoon or protective reef. And as a result, they are the first to actually feel the brunt of climate change, where waves are not only breaking over their embankments and over their shorelines, but it's springing up from within the island, inundating, for example, their airport and airstrip.
I'm curious to know how strong national pride is in the Marshall Islands, because maybe there's a split between those who want to leave and those who want to stay. And what do you tell those who want to leave?
What we're telling those who want to leave is that it's their choice. It can get very spooky for young children to be living in an island where the teacher comes and tells you, oh, we're going to have an extended recess today because of waves threatening our schoolyard. It is up to them. Our view in the government is that the people of Bikini want to move somewhere that they feel more safe at this time, using their own money. That is their call. We will support them with that. But there are many proud Marshallese who say, we're going to drown here. If it means staying until the waves come and engulf the islands, we will stay.
So the big Paris Climate Change Summit that's coming up in a few weeks, how make or break is it for your country, for its survival?
It is absolutely necessary that the Paris Agreement involves keeping of the goal under 2 degrees. It cannot be hotter than that. If it goes over 2 degrees, it spells the demise of our small island.
Tony DeBrun, you've got grandchildren growing up in the Marshall Islands. What do you think about when you think about their future?
They are the ones for whom we sound this alarm bell. They are the ones who must inherit an earth as we had. I do not want to leave for my children something less than what I inherited from my mother and my grandfather. If everybody undertook that mission, we have a chance of saving it. I have 10 grandchildren and 4 great-grandchildren, and I really think that they are in the same situation as other grandchildren and great-grandchildren throughout the world.
Tony DeBrun is the foreign minister of the Marshall Islands. He's been speaking with me from the airport in Honolulu on his way back home. Thank you very much for speaking with us. Safe travels.
Thank you very, very much.
We're not ending the week without some nod to Halloween. No way. It's a big deal in many places around the globe these days. For those in Germany who want to get a scare, they can drive 20 minutes south of Frankfurt to the crumbling ruins of Castle Frankenstein. Or is it Frankenstein? Anyway, the castle was once home to a real mad scientist, and now its doors creak open for Halloween. Caitlin Raig has that story.
The ruins of Castle Frankenstein sit high on a hill surrounded by dense forest. On this cold night, a thick fog shrouds the former fortress, making it the perfect stage for one of Germany's oldest haunted houses. Visitors nervously crowd outside the castle's front gate. A clown with fangs beckons them to enter. Inside, more scary clowns appear, jumping up behind people and pushing them into dark corners. Monsters hunt down visitors and trap them in coffins. Around 100 creatures prowl the castle grounds every night. Monsters, werewolves.
We have a lot of werewolves, and we have a monster in the swamp. And we have this bad baby with a knife as a monster here. It's good looking. It's very good looking.
Walter Schiele is a writer and historian. He spent the past few decades unearthing Castle Frankenstein's often ghoulish history through research and talking with locals.
They tell a lot of black stories around this castle.
Witches supposedly came here to drink the water from a magic spring in hopes of staying young. And Sheila says one of the castle's most famous inhabitants, Johann Conrad Dippel von Frankenstein, likely served as the inspiration for Mary Shelley's Gothic novel. Dippel was both an alchemist and grave robber at the beginning of the 18th century.
He stole the bodies, the fresh buried bodies, from the cemetery of Niederbeerbach.
Sheila says the local mayor became so angry about the grave robbing, he spread even darker rumors, saying Dippel was the blood brother of the devil and had performed a wicked experiment.
From the parts of the bodies he has robbed from our cemetery, he formed his monster.
It's alive! Oh, it's alive! It's alive! It's alive!
And this monster escaped, and now he is roaming the forest in search of virgins to play with.
Randy Van Zandt and his wife Manuela drove to Castle Frankenstein from Stuttgart, a few hours away. They didn't know much about the castle's history, but they'd heard it's one of the few places here to get really spooked at Halloween.
Because in Germany, we don't really celebrate it, so we decided this year we're going to make it a bigger deal.
Celebrating Halloween in America is a little bit more intense, can be a little bit more dramatic, but of course that's what we love.
Van Zandt is recently retired from the U.S. Army. His wife Manuela is German. Halloween was never a big deal in Germany, but that changed when the U.S. military stayed on here after World War II. The haunted house at Castle Frankenstein was actually the brainchild of U.S. soldiers who launched the event about 40 years ago. Van Zandt says he's seen interest in Halloween grow since he first came to Germany in the mid-90s.
You see a lot of German people coming on post, and the kids are doing trick-or-treating along with the American kids. So the Germans are starting to get on board, and I think they like it. They enjoy it. It's fun.
One German who's definitely fallen under Halloween's spell is Ellen Riedman. By day, she works at a bakery. At night, she performs at Castle Frankenstein, dressed as Stephen King's murderous clown, It. She still remembers her first visit to the castle.
Das war wie eine zweite Welt. Also das war unglaublich.
She says it was like another world. It was unbelievable, the effort and level of detail that's put into the show. Later, she thought, she has to take part in this. Riedman understands what draws people to the castle at Halloween every year. She says it's the kick, the adrenaline kick. People can't experience that in everyday life. And the idea that on Halloween, the worlds between the dead and the living mix, that gives people goosebumps. Those who miss the haunted house at Halloween can come back after Christmas, when the ghost of Dippel von Frankenstein supposedly appears. Locals say he sits atop the chapel roof, howling for his monster to return. For The World, I'm Caitlin Reig, Darmstadt, Germany.
It's not as scary as Frankenstein, but this music is from Banda de los Muertos, the Band of the Dead, just in time for Halloween and its Mexican after-party, Day of the Dead, Día de los Muertos.
Ya está cerrada con tres candados.
La Puerta Negra, the Black Door, is the title of this upbeat ranchera. The lyrics are somewhat menacing. The black door is closed, triple locked in fact, but only because someone's parents are trying to interfere with a budding romance. Brains number one behind Banda de los Muertos is Oscar Noriega, whose parents hail from Mexico. Brains number two is Jacob Garchik, who's covered everything from jazz to gospel to klezmer. It was bound to be an interesting match, and now they've got themselves a brass band in Brooklyn.
Pero la puerta de cien candados, o no poder a mí detenerme. Pero la puerta no es la culpable. Que tú por dentro estés llorando.
Banda de los Muertos there. Up next, everybody's gone surfing. Surfing Nazaré. This is The World.
The World's Global Nation education coverage is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, part of the American Graduate Let's Make It Happen initiative, supporting communities as they work to end the dropout crisis. AmericanGraduate.org.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. I will surf in waves a little over my head, but not bigger. So when I see dudes hurtling down huge waves that are an apartment building overhead, my stomach kind of drops. That's what they're up to right now in Nazaré, Portugal, at the World Surf League's Big Wave Awards. Sebastian Steutner is a professional big wave surfer, and if you've seen the viral video clip of a surfer taking on one of Nazaré's 60-foot swells this week, well, that's Sebastian.
It was on Tuesday, first big day of the season, which was really fun.
That was about 60 feet. Nazaré has had 100-foot waves. Today, I hear it's kind of choppy and flattened out, if 20 feet is considered flat. Are you surfing today?
yeah, we're just about to jump back into the water. And yeah, 20 feet isn't really considered big here, which is kind of strange compared to everywhere else in the world.
Yeah, so I hear there is a unique floor to the Atlantic Ocean off the coast of Nazaré that kind of creates these waves. Can you explain what's going on in this one particular part of the world?
It's an underwater canyon that starts in the middle of the Atlantic and gets more shallow and more narrow as it turns into Praia da Norte, and the waves kind of get stuck in that channel. So if you have big waves in Hawaii, you have one dominant force, one swell that brings the wave, and here you could have four or five different storms or just one little storm that just gets pushed into that canyon and reaches the highest sides because of that.
It sounds like it's almost like a funnel, and the pressure just grows and grows the closer the wave gets to the shore.
Yeah, that's it.
How fast are you moving when you're shooting down the face of the wave?
You're moving at about 40, 50 miles an hour. You have to deal with chops. You have to deal with the waves behind you because there's no channel. You have to set your line. You're constantly checking your line, constantly checking the wave. And it's a very challenging wave because it shifts a lot as you're already on the wave. So it's pretty unpredictable. You're going so fast that every chop that hits your board wants to buck you off your board. And it's really intense.
And when you say you're looking at your line, you're looking kind of like the way forward, like which way you're going to go.
Yeah, you're looking at ahead of you on the wave to check which way you're going to go, what the wave is going to do.
And forget swimming through the break. You're towed out by a jet ski, right?
Yeah, you can't match the speed of the wave by paddling because at 50 miles or 40 miles an hour, you're not able to physically paddle yourself into it.
The photographs we've been seeing from Nazaré often feature this old stone fort on a hill where the spectators watch the surfers. When you're shooting down the face of a 60-foot wave, do you ever notice anything in front of you on the shore?
If you would notice the people on the cliff, you'd be pretty close to it, and you'd be right in front of the rock, so it'd be the worst thing you want to see. I've never seen them surfing, and I don't ever want to see the spectators surfing.
Sebastian, you grew up in Germany, not a lot of waves there. How'd you get into big wave surfing?
I grew up in a little town in the south of Germany called Nuremberg, and it doesn't have any waves. There's no ocean, only lakes. Started windsurfing when I was young. And decided to move to Hawaii when I was 13 years old. And when I was 16, became a professional windsurfer. Then met a local Hawaiian family that were legends in the sport of big wave surfing and fell in love with the big waves. And it's been a passion since I was a little kid. I've loved the water. It's just for me the perfectly fitting and most natural sport to do.
So you're headed back out into the surf today. Is 20-foot surf kind of a letdown, or are you still going to have fun?
No, I have fun surfing 2-foot waves, 4-foot waves, 20-foot waves, 60-foot waves. I don't care how big the waves are or how small. And it's going to be fun for sure.
Right on. Professional surfer Sebastian Steutner, he's been speaking with us from Praia do Norte, Portugal, where he's competing in the Big Wave Awards. Good luck, Sebastian.
Thanks.
Tomorrow could be historic if you follow rugby on a couple of counts. It's the final in the Rugby World Cup between Australia and New Zealand, and we're expecting the largest TV audience ever for a rugby match. That would imply another historic first, the largest TV audience ever for a haka. I'm saying all this as if I know what I'm really talking about. So let's all pause and listen together to the sound of a haka. Wow. Wow. Okay. The World's Patrick Cox is here to help out. I know now that a haka is exciting. What exactly is it, though, Patrick?
Well, originally it is a Maori war dance, although now it's often translated. The Maori word haka is often just translated as dance. And part of the deal are these cries. The other things are gestures they do. They slap various parts of their arms and their eyes get really big and intimidating. And the other team just stand there and watch.
So the haka is originally part of indigenous Maori culture in New Zealand. What is the connection between the rugby players from New Zealand and Maori people?
There wasn't much connection until quite recently. I mean, if you look at some of the old video of hakas being performed by the rugby team a few decades ago, it was 15 white guys not looking very intimidating, performing a native dance that they really didn't have an awful lot to do with. But now the team is multi-ethnic, and it really means something. New Zealanders, not just their rugby team, but the population in general, have really embraced Maori culture, and this is very much an expression of national identity.
So there's this haka before a rugby match. Any other time a haka is used by New Zealand nationals?
Yeah. In fact, Maori leaders are now using different hakas, less warlike hakas, as a form of social intervention. There's still an enormous amount of poverty among Maori people, and social workers use the haka to send messages to the local population for, in this particular case, to dissuade them from becoming parents too young. Here's a Maori social worker called Annette. She speaks at the start in the Maori language.
There you go. You just scatter your eggs wherever you want. Take no responsibility for them. Who's going to bring up your children? And that's what we're talking about, these fatherless generations now. The haka is the one item where we can discuss or challenge any social problems that are affecting us as Māori right now.
So the haka, Patrick, plays different roles in New Zealand. It's relevant there. It's also relevant in Australia. I mean, they understand what's at stake with Māori culture. I'm just curious, though, the Aussie opponents on the rugby field, how do they react when this haka starts up at the beginning of a match? Do they just stand there and accept that they're going to get psyched out?
Yeah, pretty much so. In fact, the way that opponents usually try to reverse the psych out is by standing very, very still and just staring right back at the New Zealanders. But it'll be interesting to see what the Australians do tomorrow. What they won't do is something that their women's team did a few years ago and got fined for, which was to advance on the New Zealand team during the haka itself. That was considered disrespectful.
The World's Patrick Cox. Thanks as always.
You're welcome, Marco.
We have more on the haka and Maori language in our podcast, The World in Words. You can find it at iTunes or at pri.org/language. And that is a reminder to you that The World is not just a radio program. We're also on the web 24/7. So let's give a tip of the hat to our digital team led by editor David Beard. The people pulling oars in his boat are Ann Bailey, Stephen Davey, James Edwards, Jared Goyette, Jonathan Keeling, Moira Lavelle, Isis Madrid, Kieran Peterson, and Anjali Shah. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Have a great weekend. We'll see you back here Monday.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, brought to you by PRI's Global Reporting Fund, supporting its diverse reporting efforts, including ongoing global health coverage and its Across Women's Lives initiative. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman, Garrett and Cecilia Boone, the Gruber Family Foundation, Lynn and Bruce Dayton, and the Harold Simmons Foundation. The Plowshares Fund, a global security foundation working to build a world where nuclear weapons will never be used again. By the Ford Foundation, by the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, and by the PRI Ambassador Council, including Linda Larson and Jerry Johnson, the Rose Family Fund, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and Roger Hale and Nor Hall, and by the National Endowment for the Arts.
PRI, Public Radio International.